From the Independent Producer Project and KCRW, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is a program of true stories, personal documentaries, and radio movies. Conrad Anker is a man who's climbed some of the tallest peaks all over the world. But on one particular climb in 1999, he was high up the mountain Shishapangma in Tibet with two companions when there was an accident.
All of a sudden, there was like this crack, and we were off and running, and we were fighting for our life. I saw the immensity of this avalanche come down, and I was like, I'm gonna lay down before the avalanche hits. And as I looked over, David and Alex were still upright, and they were still running.
The avalanche lasted just a bit longer than it took you to listen to that clip, but the snow threw Conrad Anker 30 yards. He was half buried and badly hurt.
I remember standing up and walking around and going over to where I had seen them, and it's like, Alex and David are gone. And it was as if some higher being had just taken them away from the earth and left it silent afterwards.
Alex Lowe was 40 years old. David Bridges was only 29. Those tragic events are recounted in the award-winning 2015 documentary film called Maru. And on this episode of Unfictional, it's an incredible kind of follow-up story. It comes by way of a podcast called The Document, which is also from KCRW. And it's about documentary film, but not in a way you've ever heard before. The Document might focus on footage and stories that were cut out of a classic documentary, for example, or examine a single moment of a famous film that has extra meaning when viewed years later. Or in the case of this episode, it's a story that comes after the cameras have stopped rolling and a closing chapter. 16 years after they disappeared, the bodies of Alex Lowe and David Bridges were found on the mountain. But then, only a month later, a group of their friends and family headed to Tibet to recover their bodies. The story is told by the host of The Document, my colleague Matt Holtzman, who you've heard on this program a few times. This is called Because It's There. From KCRW, it's Unfictional.
At Sundance a couple of years ago, I saw a jaw-dropping documentary called Maru. It's named after a Himalayan mountain that was the obsession of a world-class climber named Conrad Anker.
Maru is the culmination of all I've done, and all I've wanted to do is this peak and this climb.
This is the test of the master climber. Jimmy and Conrad have climbed Everest four or five times. This is a whole different kind of climbing.
16 days up here.
We lost half our food, and 90% of the mountain was still above us.
The center of the universe is unattainable.
The images of the mountains in Maru are just spectacular. But the movie's also a little bit terrifying because it takes you on what was thought to be an unclimbable climb. 20,000 feet of freezing, snow and wind-pummeled mountain topped by a vertical face of jagged rock. You can't help but watch these people happily hanging from a cliff by their frostbitten fingers and not ask yourself if oxygen deprivation hasn't permanently warped their brains. And I really wanted to know, why do they do it? Now, the only person that I even suspect of ever scaling anything other than the Matterhorn at Disneyland is my friend Joel Corey. I had seen a picture of him out in his garage where he's standing on top of a mountain somewhere. And it turns out he's climbed all over the world.
Mountain climbing was central to my life when I was younger. I typically describe myself as a climber. Oh, and I'm a criminal defense attorney.
So when I came back from Sundance, I told him about the movie Maru, and I asked Joel to try to explain the appeal. And he talked almost religiously about the adrenaline and the beauty and the camaraderie and the sense of accomplishment and the because it's there of it all.
To me, a big mountain is a puzzle that if I can unlock, it'll take me to a threshold between heaven and earth. And standing on a summit, I feel a unique connection with the universe. It's almost like I am gigantic and insignificant at the same time.
Nirvana can come at a cost, and Joel knew it as well as anyone. David Bridges, who'd been buried in that avalanche with Alex Lowe, David Bridges was Joel's mentor and one of his closest friends.
He took me under his wing and taught me how to rock climb. And he taught me the art of high altitude mountaineering. Later, he taught me how to ice climb. We looked for sports that got our adrenaline pumping and our heart pounding.
But their bond was more than just the love of adrenaline. It was love. Dave invited Joel and a female friend named Yolanda on a climbing trip to Nepal, and Dave suggested that Joel might be interested in her. And he was. She became Joel's wife and a climbing partner, and eventually the mother of his two kids. Joel eventually traded his Pitons for a Prius. He was now 56 years old. It had been 15 years since his last big climb when the news reached him that the body of David Bridges had been discovered.
16 years ago, the news saddened many across the world. Renowned climber Alex Lowe and cameraman David Bridges were killed in an avalanche in the Himalayas.
Well, their story is back in the headlines now after hikers finally found the men frozen in ice.
I had struggled for a number of years dealing with the fallout from Dave's death, and I frankly didn't process it very well.
Then Joel got a call from Bill, a mutual friend he shared with the Lost Climbers.
He said something that really hit home for me. He said, "We have to go, and we have to carry the boys off the mountain. It's on us, Joel." And he said it so matter-of-fact. He said it like it was in a scene out of a movie. And I go, okay. And I hung up the phone, and I got out of my car, and I just started sobbing because that phrase really hit me.
So you had a conversation with your wife about this? What was that conversation like?
The first conversation was me approaching her and expressing ambivalence about going on the trip. And her reaction was immediate. She said, "You absolutely must go." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because if you don't go, you will regret this for the rest of your life."
But as the trip got closer, Joel's wife, Yolanda, remember, she'd been a climber too, she started to have second thoughts.
And I said, "Oh, you have nothing to be afraid of." I said, this is a very safe trip, and we're going to be very cautious. And don't worry about it." And she said, "Okay, let me see if I have this correct. You're going up on a mountain when you are not in any kind of shape to climb a mountain. You're going to go on a glacier where two of the strongest climbers the U.S. has ever seen were buried by an avalanche. And you're going to dig their bodies out, and you're going to carry them off the mountain. And somehow I shouldn't be worried." I said, "Well, when you say it like that, yeah, it sounds much more dangerous than it really is."
The truth is, high altitude is dangerous, period. Dave and Alex, they had been killed when they were just basically strolling across a glacier. And their bodies were way up there, buried somewhere around 20,000 feet, which was about 20,000 feet higher and 50% less oxygen than Joel's house near the beach.
So it requires acclimatization. Acclimatization only happens by being at altitude. You know, people get sick driving from Los Angeles to Mammoth Mountain.
Even when he was an active climber, Joel would train for at least half a year before a big trip. But less than a month after he got the news that the bodies of Alex Lowe and his friend David Bridges had been found, he said goodbye to his wife and kids and law practice, and he was on a plane to Tibet and a mountain called Shishapangma. Some people called it the throne of God.
"We would like to thank you for flying Air China."
It's amongst the highest mountains in the world, a snowy, steep line of peaks straddling the border of Tibet and Nepal. It's at least a four-day trip from LA, starting with a 13-hour flight to Beijing, which is where Joel met up with the friends and family of Alex Lowe and David Bridges.
"No, we were on a different flight from Los Angeles."
There was Bill, the mountain climbing equipment designer who'd helped convince Joel to go on this trip. There was Daryl, Joel's college roommate and an ER doctor, David Bridges' brother, Dan, and Alex Lowe's widow, Jenny, and her three sons, Max, Sam, and Isaac. They'd been boys when their father was killed, but they were now young men.
Hi there.
How you going?
Good, I'm Joel.
Max,
good to meet you.
Joel,
nice to meet you.
Hey, Dan.
Where's Daryl at?
He's in bed. Oh,
okay.
So it's
just
us for dinner. Isaac, good to meet you.
If you listen carefully there, you could also hear the voice of Conrad Anker, the man featured in the documentary Maru. He had been Alex Lowe's partner and best friend. Together, they were two of the rock stars of the climbing world. And Conrad Anker was there that day in 1999. In the aftermath of Alex Lowe's death, Conrad Anker and Alex's widow, Jenny, found each other, and they fell in love. Conrad married Jenny Lowe and adopted her three young sons, and now he was here in Tibet with her and the kids and Joel Corey and the others to lead the mission up Shishapangma.
We get there in the evening. We all go out to dinner. And there was sort of an awkwardness to it all because we're eating Chinese food with a bunch of people that I don't know well. And everybody's just kind of like off in their own world, and we eat our food, we go upstairs, we go to sleep, we wake up the next day, we grab the mountain of gear that we have and get on the plane. We're all jet lagged, and we fly to Lhasa.
They spent a couple of days in the Tibetan capital taking in the markets and the palaces and temples.
This is the new palace. This is the old one.
Yes, you can say new palace.
Yeah.
And getting used to being at 12,000 feet above sea level. Then the group packed their bags for the two-day, 450-mile drive to Shishapangma. Physically, the trip had been pretty easy, but emotionally, it was hard.
It's like every time we got closer, one more day, it's like you could feel like this stress just cranking up. And there was this real tension weighing on everybody.
Even without the emotional baggage, a trip like this is a logistical nightmare. There was constant haggling about things big and small, from who was going to ride in which SUV to how to carry the desiccated bodies down the mountain. In Ayalam, the little border town in the shadow of Shishapangma, the group was joined by two Sherpas who'd climbed many times with Conrad, and a local who'd act as the expedition's spiritual guide. And they all met to finalize plans in a tea house, basically someone's converted living room. It was easy to get caught up in the excitement of planning a climb.
Are the act drivers carrying anything?
They carry a little day pack, and they've thrown something. But if each of the members takes a sleeping bag and your foam pad and your toiletries, that will, I mean, we're not going to be that heavy going up there.
But it was also hard to forget why they were here, to retrieve the bodies of their loved ones and nothing more. And after they retrieved them, they had agreed to give them a traditional burial by burning them on a funeral pyre.
Well, how much wood do they recommend that we take for each body?
So the idea that is that you make all the wood and then you put the body on top. Yes. Their body will be fresh because they've been in the ice.
The waitress in the tea house where they met was a young teenager, probably the daughter of the people who owned the place. As she sat in a corner brushing her hair, Joel couldn't help but think about his own teenagers back home and about Alex Lowe's sons.
Going on the trip, I was an emotional basket case. You know, all of the emotion that I had suppressed, that I had ignored, now was right there in my face.
Hand me that. Let the games begin.
Early in the morning, a caravan of trucks and SUVs pulled up to the 2.5-star Snowland Hotel. It was the same place that David Bridges, Alex Lowe, and Conrad Anker had stayed before their tragic climb in 1999.
And there's just all this nervous energy, like you're like a bunch of kids dressed to go on a field trip, and you're like, "Where are the buses? Where are the buses? Let's go, let's go." And I remember when we finally were told, "Okay, we're going to hike in." And they drove us in the SUVs to the end of the road, literally, and said, "Okay, this is the spot." And we piled out and we put our backpacks on and we took all our bags, and the porters were there. They had a whole team of yaks, and they start loading the yaks.
It was a moody day in the low 40s. Visibility was limited, and it was threatening to rain. The hikers disappeared into the mist like they were walking into the afterlife itself.
Set out this morning on the trailhead, hiking to our first base camp. Yaks are bringing up most of our gear, and yet somehow my light pack wound up being stuffed with about 40, 50 pounds worth of stuff. Anyway, just a minute ago, clouds cleared, and I got my first glimpse of Shishapangma, massive mountain, 14th highest peak in the world. Didn't get a really great view of it. It's kind of like a shadowy ghost in the clouds.
The valley was rocky and stark, but it was beautiful in its own way. They crossed a one-man rope bridge over a stream rushing with glacial water. But a hike that should have taken them 8 hours took much longer.
So we just start hiking and hiking and hiking and hiking and hiking. And, you know, supposedly this very casual trek in turned into this 12, 14-hour death march.
They finally reached the first base camp and dug in for the night, wiped out by the day's trek. And then they collapsed in their sleeping bags for the chilly night. The following day, there was another 8 hours of hiking. The goal this time, though, was the ABC, the Advanced Base Camp. It was located on a beautiful plateau right below the glaciers of Shishapangma. The green moss that covered the rocky ground was dotted with tiny purple flowers.
This was a little area that had a little lake, and it was a place where the climbing team 16 years ago had built a little memorial for Dave and Alex and carved their names into stones, which were still there. And this is where we were going to set out.
Even at 16,000 feet, the ABC was still a ways away from where the bodies of their friends rested. So they camped for a couple of nights and got accustomed to the altitude and some very raw emotions. And they agreed on a plan. They'd hike to a ridge near the glacier, then split into two groups. Conrad Anker's group would actually venture out onto the glacier where the danger was greatest. The other would not. And then they'd carry the bodies back down to base camp. But the plan started to fall apart right from the start. It was a night of restless sleep at the ABC. The altitude had started to take its toll, especially on David Bridges' brother Dan, who was basically incapacitated. Joel's group wanted to give him a little extra time to recover so he could go along on the final ascent. But Conrad decided to stick to the original plan and left with his group in the early morning darkness. It was somewhere around 4 a.m. And Joel and his group waited, but Dan just wasn't getting any better. So Daryl, the doctor, put Jenny in charge of his care.
Maybe every other hour walk him around, because if he's acting drunk, so when he gets the O's, that's when we might have to get him out of here.
Joel's group ended up getting a very late start, somewhere around 9. Jenny's two younger sons, who were planning on staying at the ABC with their mom, decided to go along. It was a clear day, but not very pleasant, maybe 20 degrees with wind chill. You can understand why Jenny, who'd lost her husband in this very place, was very nervous.
So okay. I just told Sam I'd like to know what's going on by 4. So I want one of my boys to run back down here.
I don't feel good about that. I think 6 is reasonable because 4 is a little early. I think we got to stay tight because if we
it's safer
he
as a
gets
group
lost,
than
we're hosed.
I don't want anybody here later than 6 or I'm going to be going crazy.
Okay, great.
That's right. Too many people up there too high at night with no bivy gear.
Agreed.
Oh, great. So but everybody needs to be.
They hiked and hiked, and Joel did his best to keep up. The two young men on his team didn't make things any easier.
It was like following a couple of thoroughbred racehorses. These guys are charging ahead.
After more than 6 hours, Joel's group arrived at what they thought was the meeting point.
When we got to the base of the mountain, you could see spots where people had possibly camped. But the one thing we didn't see was any evidence of our team. So we're standing at the base of the mountain saying, I wonder if we're on the right ridge.
They would have been more concerned if they just weren't so exhausted. All they could do was wait, and that's what they did. At 3:34 in the afternoon, it started getting colder and darker, and Joel was starting to get sick. Daryl gave him some pills to help.
People ask, you know, what's it like to have high altitude sickness? It's kind of like you deciding to run a marathon wearing a bag over your head.
By the time they decided to turn around, Joel wasn't just sick, he'd run out of water.
You're going downhill, so you have gravity, fortunately. But I still would have to stop every 2 minutes and stop and breathe and catch my breath. And the more you breathe, the more dehydrated you become. We finally got back down to base camp, and it was just as the sun was setting, it was starting to get dark. We walked in, and now the four of us were exhausted. I mean, we had been hiking continuously for 6-9 hours or so.
Joel's group had seen no evidence of the other group all day, and now it was dark and very cold. But there was nothing they could do but try and recover from their hike. Besides, it was Conrad Anker up there. He's one of the world's strongest mountaineers.
We started drinking a little soup and rehydrating. We immediately collapsed in our tents.
A couple of hours later, nature called.
So I was out using the bathroom when I heard a yell from the ridge. And I screamed out to everyone, "I hear them." Isaac got up and blew his whistle and then said he was done, he couldn't do more. And I said, "I know I heard them." And a few minutes later, I heard another yell. So we got clothed as fast as we could and we ran over to the ridge and we could see them.
Dan, David Bridges' brother, who'd been prostrate with altitude sickness the whole time, heard the commotion from his tent.
Dan, you know, summoned the strength and the courage to run up to that ridge. And the moment we got to the first team member who was carrying the body on his back, his first words were, "This is Dave." And so Dan and I took Dave's body off of him, and we carried it the rest of the way down the ridge and back to our base camp, while the other team carried Alex's body, and Isaac and Sam, who were up ahead, took their father's body and carried their father's body down the ridge and back to base camp. Jenny was out, and she was just overcome with emotion. It was really hard for everyone. You know, we didn't know what to do at that point, and so we just put the bodies next to each other, and we just cried and hugged each other.
The next morning when it was light out, they went back to the bodies for final goodbyes.
Jenny sat down, and one of the first things she did was she retrieved Alex's wedding ring. And then Daryl collected the DNA samples and put them into a bag. And then he moved to Dave's body. And I remember I came over because I just wanted to see his body one last time. And the second I saw his wrist, I knew it was my friend. I recognized him. And then we began the process of preparing them for cremation. We took their bodies and we wrapped them in kata scarves, which are these silk scarves. We put incense around it. We each brought something personal to leave and put with his body. I had this little emblem that my wife had made for us when we'd first traveled to Nepal in 95 together. We built the wood pyre, and we walked around the pyre 3 times in a clockwise direction. And then we laid his body on the pyre. The boys, Conrad and Jenny, picked up Alex's body and did the same. We walked around the pyre and then laid them next to each other. We said prayers. We said our goodbyes. And then Jenny and Dan lit the pyre on fire.
I don't know if I ever told you. I don't know if I ever told you how grateful I am to you. Love you, Dave. I hope you can find some peace. Peace, brother.
After his trip to Tibet, Joel Khoury returned to his wife and kids in Los Angeles.
When I got back, I told everyone this was the exclamation point to my climbing career. It was over. But even now, I still look at big mountains differently than non-climbers. And I know I'm never going to stand on the summit of a big mountain ever again, but I don't know that I'm quite ready to get rid of my last climbing axe either.
So, in an earlier conversation, I said, how would you describe yourself back in the day? And you said, I was a climber, and oh, by the way, I'm a defense attorney. And I wonder how you describe yourself now.
A parent, a criminal defense attorney, a volleyball player. Oh, and I used to climb.
No one knows exactly how many climbers remained frozen in the snow and ice on the world's highest mountains. But there are estimated to be more than 200 on Mount Everest alone.
That piece was produced by Matt Holtzman for his KCRW podcast called The Document. Find a link to that show, along with pictures from the climb, a link to the documentary, and the entire archive of Unfictional. It's at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. And if you haven't already, I invite you to podcast this program on iTunes or wherever you like to download podcasts. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Unfictional, in particular because this program is going through a transformation in the coming months, and those are the best places to hear about it. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The editor is Nick White. The associate producer is Carla Green. I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional from KCRW.